This podcast was recorded at Hartford Street Zen Center, Isanji, in San Francisco. Please help support our temple by making a donation at hscc.org.
I'd like to start off by thanking Reverend Hill for inviting me and having me here, and for all of you for taking care of your life in this way of coming out to a Dharma talk. And thank you to my teachers, Seke Harada Roshi and Shosan Vicky Austin, for all of their incredible wisdom and support over the years. And so I want to say a few words today about identity. And I really feel like this is a topic that is very much up for us. Topic that, you know, whether we are talking about race relations or we're talking about feminism or gender identity or sexual orientation, the gaps between classes, there are any number of different ways that this expresses itself in our society. And in particular now, when the issues of race are very strongly in our public consciousness, it's a big question. And for Buddhists in particular, I think it can often be a very vexing question. Can be a little confusing because of the teaching of no self. So some of you may have heard of this particular teaching. The teaching of no self essentially means that there is no permanently abiding self, that there's no self that arises independent of causes and conditions. Or you could say that there's no self that is fixed even for an instant, that there's this constant flux. And yet, to be really clear, Buddhism doesn't say that there is not a sense of self. It doesn't deny the appearance of the arising and the falling away of a self that we experience as me. So we're not saying that that's not true about how we experience the world, right? Dogen put it very succinctly by saying, to study the self is to forget the self, right? When we really investigate the ways, the identities that we have, even our physical self, it changes over time. It's not really ever exactly what we think it was. And he follows that immediately with the other half, which is, to forget the self is to be actualized by the myriad things. Right? So this is the beauty of our lives. That this finding ourselves to be not what we think we are also means finding ourselves to be incredibly vast beings, informed by literally all things. And that can be a relief, right? That can be a relief. That you don't have to defend this wall between you and the next thing or the next person. Or it can also be difficult sometimes to really accept the flow, right? I think in particular aging is a good way in which we often find a little bit of resistance to relinquishing our understanding of self, our understanding of self as defined by this body. But there is this teaching that it is clearly always in flux. And I want to say this is not just an old Asian teaching that comes to us out of the East. There was also this idea in Western culture as well. Some of you might know Heraclitus. He was a Greek philosopher around 500 BC, so as well as we can tell, 50 years plus or minus the Buddhist time. And Heraclitus was a Greek philosopher who is known as the obscure. Because he would go around saying things like this. He said, he is very famous for saying, "We both step and do not step into the same river. We are and we are not." Right? Beautiful. It can't possibly be the same river because it's always in the course of flow. And we are also always in the course of flow. And he got that. He got that. He was also known as the weeping philosopher because he was very, very misunderstood in Greek culture. So I feel for him. Heraclitus. But just to say that, you know, this isn't a particularly cultural understanding of the world necessarily, right? It has come to us through certain cultures. We imbue it with our own culture, frankly, but it, I would say, is a teaching that is completely independent of culture. So all of this sort of raises the bigger question, I believe, of how then do we honor the things that make us unique? How then do we honor both the understanding that no identity, no label is ever complete, right? That none of those things actually fully capture what it means to be a person. Anything you can name, literally. And yet, we are fully informed by the causes and conditions that have come before, by the causes and conditions that are here in this moment. Right? We are informed by our preferences, our bodies, our form of expression, our interaction with people who have ideas about those things. So I want to give you, if there's time, two examples of how to work with this. And the first one is from the a nun whose name is Vajira. I'm sorry because my pronunciation in Sanskrit terms is often not the best, but... And this is a story from the Samyutta Nikaya, which is this big tome, one of many big tomes that are part of the original canon, we say, the original Pali teachings of the Buddha. And the connected discourses are described by some scholars as the Buddha's stories illuminating his lessons, his insights on the path to awakening. So these are stories not about the Buddha, but that the Buddha told to illustrate a point. So this story about Venerable Vajira is very brief, so I'll just read you the whole thing, if you'll bear with me. At Savati, then, in the morning, the bhikkhuni Vajira dressed and taking bowl and robe, entered Savati for alms. When she had walked for alms in Savati and had returned from her alms round, after her meal, she went to the blind men's grove for the day's abiding. Having plunged into the blind men's grove, she sat down at the foot of a tree for the day's abiding. Then Mara, the evil one, desiring to arouse fear, trepidation, and terror in the bhikkhuni Vajira, desiring to make her fall away from concentration, approached her and addressed her in verse. By whom has this being been created? Where is the maker of the being? Where has the being arisen? Where does the being cease? Then it occurred to the bhikkhuni Vajira, now who is that reciting the verse? A human being or a non-human being? Then it occurred to her, this is Mara, the evil one, who has recited the verse desiring to arouse fear, trepidation, and terror in me, desiring to make me fall away from concentration. Then the bhikkhuni Vajira, having understood, this is Mara, the evil one, replied to him in verses, why now do you assume a being? Mara, is that your speculative view? This is a heap of sheer formations. Here no being is found. Just as with an assemblage of parts, the word chariot is used, so when the aggregates exist, there is the convention of being. It is only suffering that comes to be, or that comes to arise. Suffering that stands and falls away. Nothing but suffering comes to be, nothing but suffering ceases. Then Mara, the evil one, realizing the bhikkhuni Vajira knows me, sad and disappointed, disappeared right there. So, kind of interesting, right? This is an example, you might say, of how to work with doubt or fear, or the mind that doesn't want to be concentrated and at peace, right? Who is Mara? You know, one of the things that we do quite often in Buddhist teaching is embody different energies, right? We ourselves embody different energies, but we also like to create images, right? So Avalokiteshvara as an embodiment of the energy of compassion, or Manjushri as an embodiment of the energy of wisdom. Right? Or Samantabhadra as the embodiment of skillful action. So Mara, we might understand Mara to be an embodiment of doubt, corrosive doubt, right? Or of hindrance, of evil as defined as that which takes us away from the path, that which obstructs our view of our own Buddha nature, right? So there, she's sitting and she realizes she has these doubts. What about the creator? Who is the maker of this being? And when will this being cease? right? Those might be some big questions that would arise. Some doubts that would occur to her as a practitioner who's heard a different teaching, right? Who's actually taken a vow to practice a different teaching. So she refers in her response to Mara, she refers to this metaphor of the chariot. And she says, just as with an assemblage of parts the word chariot is used, so when the aggregates exist, there is the convention of being. And this metaphor of the chariot is one that comes from the Buddha, is said to have come from the Buddha originally. It refers actually back to an Indian text called The Questions of King Milinda. And King Milinda was a very questioning character. And the original, the very beginning of the sutra starts with the king questioning the Buddha about who he is, and the Buddha giving this teaching of no self. And the king kind of didn't appreciate it, let's say, originally. So the Buddha explains it like a chariot, and he says, do you ride in a chariot? And the king says, well, of course I ride in a chariot. And he says, well, is the chariot the axle? Is the chariot the wheel? Is the chariot the cabin, the part that you ride in? It's none of those things. Where is there a chariot? Right? Chariot is a way, is a concept around these various parts. In the same way that the sense of self is a concept that we have around the various parts that arise, the body, the mind, sense perceptions. Or another metaphor that's used for this sometimes is the banana tree. For those of you, well, I don't see anybody in here who looks Latino, but in case there are any Latinos around, you might relate to the banana tree as an example. If you peel it away, it's not like a tree where you would peel away the bark and there would be some core of the tree. A banana tree is actually only made up of the leaves. If you continue to just peel away the leaves, yes, she's there's somebody nodding here. She maybe knows, has seen one in parts of Asia also. And in southern Florida, that's where I grew up. You just peel it away and there's nothing there. You know, just like an onion, there's no core to it. So, we can understand we can perhaps experience less suffering about the changing nature of this being if we can really accept from the beginning the changing nature of this being. You know? And yet, again, that doesn't mean, I don't think, the teaching is not telling us that we need to let go of all of our concepts, all of our identity, because those things are momentarily appearing to arise. And to deny them is also a mistake. I won't get into a lot of Nagarjuna because it can get complicated, but Nagarjuna, who was a much later philosopher, Indian philosopher, about 100 years into the common era, said what we typically call a tetralemma. So everything is real, everything is not real, things are both real and not real, things are neither real nor not real, right? So, for example, if you think of gravity, so gravity is real. It's a force that we can experience. We know when it's there, we know when it's not there. it's not real in the sense that, again, it's just an arising. It's just something that is created out of the position of different planets in relation to one another, or different bits of matter in relation to one another. Right? So if you pull it apart, where is this thing called gravity? Well, you wouldn't really find it. It's both real and not real, in that we can experience both of those two things, right? As human beings, that's part of our life, experiencing both of those two things. And then we get to what I find to be the most difficult one, which is the neither real nor not real side of things, which points really at inconceivability. You know, we have all kinds of mathematical formulas to define gravity, and yet every once in a while you read in the paper that we found a new way that it doesn't work the way we thought it works. Right? Black holes or blue giant stars or various other things. So all of this, I think, deserves a very sustained inquiry. It's really a lifetime practice. But the question, again, is how can we take this and really apply it in a way that it becomes a support to us in our lives and in our practice? Because the Buddha didn't give us this teaching in order to make us feel bad or in order to make us feel like we don't exist, but rather to help free us from the suffering of clinging to that. So my second example is a little bit more current, although you guys might laugh when you hear what it's from. But my second example is a koan, which might provide a little bit of guidance about skillful responses teaching. And it's said to be a conversation between Guishan and Yangshan. So these were 8th century Chinese Chan monks. And they were the founders of the Igyo Zen tradition. So there used to be 5 schools of Zen, and this was one of the 5 schools of Zen, these 2 monks. So the story goes like this. Yangshan was digging on a hillside in an effort to make a rice paddy. Right? So some of you may have seen photos of what this looks like. You know, there are these very mild little hills, and they make terraces on the hills, right, so that there are these flat areas to make rice paddies. So Yangshan was digging on the hillside making a rice paddy, and he said to Guishan, "This place is so low, and that place is so high." So Guishan was his master, right, his teacher, the abbot of the monastery where he lived. And Guishan replied, "Water makes things equal, so why don't you level it with water?" Water makes things equal, so why don't you level it with water? And Yangshan replied, "Water is not reliable, teacher. A high place is high level, and a low place is low level." And Guishan agreed. So that's the story. And it seems to me, from the perspective of today, modern times, that what Yangshan is commenting on is he's commenting that he is in the lower position. Right? He says, this place is so low, and that place is so high. Right, allegorically. I mean, he's of course talking about the hill also, and making a rice paddy and having to try to make a level field. But metaphorically, I believe he's talking about his lower position as the student, and his lower position as the worker, and his lower position as a monk. In contrast to Guishan's higher position as the teacher, and higher position as the observer, and higher position as the abbot. So he's pointing out the differences. So the master says, "Why don't you just even things up? with a little bit of water. And so water is a very common image in Buddhism. You might think, for example, of that we talk about the ocean of reality or the ocean of wisdom. So water stands for the unity of all things. And so Kweishan's response is basically, you could just even it up. You could just see it as all equal. You don't have to see it as difference. You could see it as all equal. But Yangshan doesn't fall for that. Right? Yangshan doesn't agree. And he responds by saying, water is not reliable. Water is not reliable. In other words, you can't just gloss over the differences. Just because there is unity does not mean that there isn't difference. That's not a skillful way to practice with the differences, to simply fall to the side of unity, because the two are not in opposition. The two are fully expressed. Right? So he goes on and he says, a high place is a high level and a low place is a low level. In other words, accepting things as they are in that moment, starting from a place of acknowledging things as they are in that moment. Because if you can't acknowledge what's actually present, then you can't actually practice with it. So Kweishan agreed that this is a correct view. Right? And it's from that place of acknowledging what's actually present and the differences that we begin to see how we are related, how teacher and student arise, how high and low arise in our awareness, or appear to arise, you might say. Because we can't just make everything the same. That wouldn't be the appropriate thing to do, even if we could. So a wonderful example of this actually was recently pointed out to me. I was at a talk over at the Graduate Theological Union that was being given by a Hindu scholar who was talking about Mahatma Gandhi and his relationship with the Reverend Charles Freer, an Episcopalian priest, who was a very, very good friend, incredibly close friend of his. And this scholar was talking about their relationship in framed by the teachings of the Ramayana, which is one of the old Vedic Hindu teachings, pre-Buddha, pre-Shakyamuni Buddha. And Gandhi valued their relationship because of this sense of shared identity that they had. He thought of them as both being seekers and servants. That's how he described it. They were both seekers and they were both servants to the cause of alleviating human suffering. And yet, they were quite different. And Gandhi said, you know, when we disagree, which happens quite often, he just deluges me with letters and he doesn't wait for a response. And I think that that's beautiful, because to me that is love speaking to love. It doesn't wait for a response. So, returning to the story, I just want to also point out a couple of things. One is, it starts with self-awareness. Right? Yangshan would not have been able to identify the differences and the relationship if it didn't start with some awareness about himself, his role, what he was doing, and the relationship between the sameness and the difference. And I also want to note that it's Yangshan who gives the teaching words in this story. He's not just the student, he's also the teacher. So by really deeply acknowledging the difference and really deeply acknowledging the unity, Yangshan is able actually to make a dynamic change right then. Right? He shows us that actually the way to level the differences is not by glossing over them. He demonstrates that by his own words. So, listening to ourselves, acknowledging what's present in ourselves, in the world around us, acknowledging the differences and the way that those differences bring us into relationship. Bring us into a dynamic that has the possibility of bringing out the Buddha nature in all of us. So I'll pause here and just encourage you all to express your differences. Because that's what makes it the world that brings us together. Thank you. And I'm happy to address any questions or hear your comments, your thoughts. Yes?
Can you say a little bit about our sitting practice in terms of that dynamic?
Mm-hmm. Sure. So for me, the question was, would I say a few words about our sitting practice and that this dynamic that I'm describing? You know, again, going back to this story of the Venerable Vajira, so our sitting practice is full of the details of life sometimes, right? Often. This is the activity of mind. This is the function of mind, right? We're receiving all the sense perceptions. We're processing things that have happened in the past or the future, so thinking about the future. This is part of our experience, right? And yet, this sitting still in the midst of that activity, or the quiet, the stillness that can also happen, this sitting and being present with that, we experience that, you could say, we experience that we continue to appear to arise, we continue to be, even as those things fall away, even as those things are churning. For me, I think it's that we find some safety, we find some place that it's that of learning that it's okay to watch it come and watch it go. And that's what Vajira was doing when she challenged, really, her own doubt. She challenged her own questions. You know, she was really, I think, in a very energetic way, She was giving herself permission to let go of that aspect. That's why it disappeared. Yes.
There's something that struck me as runs possibly parallel to what you've been talking about. Recently on YouTube, I just was wandering around and I hit on the philosopher Zizek, the Central European guy. And he was talking about tolerance. He's against it. And as good liberals, we're all supposed to be tolerant. But he did a little digging into, you know, some of the obvious, some of the stuff is pretty obvious, that tolerance, if you look deep enough, you can kind of find condescension. But beyond that, he wanted to affirm two things at the same time. And as a non-dualist, hopefully, I would like to do that. And he wanted to affirm people's cultures as they are going to be what they are, and you don't have to destroy your own culture or cultural sense of identity to help another. So there are times when identity politics, which was what you started out with, and I kind of wanted to bring it back to that. For the first time in my life, in the past couple of years, I've been seeing the limitations of that. And that makes me actually more appreciative, not tolerant, appreciative of other identities and their fluidity. I am not a big fat queen all the time. I am a lot of things at different times, and that's just one thing. And anybody else's identity is the same thing. Mm-hmm. So, sort of, I wanted to kind of see if you had a response to getting it back to where you started in identity politics.
Yes, thank you. So that, what I hear you pointing to there is actually one of the most hopeful aspects about our practice, which is that we, in every moment, have the opportunity to respond in a skillful way. We don't have to be whatever we were a minute ago. And this is true for everyone, right? And at the same time, we know that people have their tendencies, people have their background, people have their culture, and it's expressed inevitably. It's very hard, actually, to be completely neutral. It would be almost impossible, I think. We are so, you know, we were having a conversation the other day about unconscious bias and the way that there are things that are not known to us, not visible to us about ourselves, that can be perceived by other people. Some of those things would be cultural, for example. You know, you just have this basic understanding because of the way you grew up. And it doesn't show up until you encounter somebody else who doesn't have that particularly. That kind of mirroring and that kind of coming into interaction can actually show it to you a little bit, you know. The issue that we get into in terms of politics, you know, race politics, is the way that plays itself out in harmful ways, right? The way that that sense of separation becomes extreme, completely extreme, so that we're not able actually to see the other person as a full human being, as a whole human being, right? And you start to think of that other person as being completely evil or completely lacking civility in some way. You know, I think of like the Nazis calling the Jews less than human, right? Or I think of the video that I saw of Walter Lamar Scott being shot in the back, like an animal, really. That's what his father said when he saw the video. He said he felt like his son was being shot down like a deer, like this guy was just like a hunter, this policeman. And I, you know, don't know much about this officer who did that thing, except for seeing his photo and his clear shock and in his face, his photo being booked. So that's the problem that we run into, right? That it can go to the other extreme. So to really walk that balance of acknowledging and not glossing over, right? That's what I hear in terms of tolerance as a way of like glossing over things or condescending or not really being able to be real about it, right? So we don't want to fall to that side and we don't want to fall to the other side of being really unable to meet someone because we are completely blinded by the way that we define them, the way that they define themselves. I don't know if that responds to your question at all. Thank you. Yes?
So, thank you very much for your talk. When you talk about the chariot, I have a question. You talk about the chariot and it's a collection of parts, just as there's the aggregates, which are a collection which is constantly shifting. But the chariot has functionality. And I think it's just another term, I guess, of saying, so, it, and we as beings, even though that we're a shifting collection, we have functionality
mm-hmm.
too, like
mm-hmm.
provisional functionality with
mm-hmm.
our imprints and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So Buddhist practice is such a precious gift. I mean, it's like there's the teachings of the alignment with, I'm going to say, virtuous activity, patience, generosity. Or the functionality could be shaped by our greed, hate, and delusion. So it's just
mm-hmm.
sort of the awareness of those possibilities and the guidance of the practice. I'm just sort of doing a word thing right now. But and then as we come in to interaction with others, being aware of that, I mean, just the provisionalness of the self, but I guess my thing was functionality.
Right. So key in this whole process is our awareness of our volition, right? Awareness of our ability to act, and to some extent our responsibility to act, right? According to the precepts, according to the teachings of wisdom, right? So, and this is where karma comes into it. So karma, you know, karmic consciousness, as you know, we just have been talking about, it's arising, and it's arising in all kinds of very complex ways. We need to really try our best to understand that. I mean, frankly, karma isn't exactly deterministic, you might say. There's a whole number of different factors involved in each karmic consequence, but every time we take an action, every time we say something, even having thoughts, we're creating some karma there. So that is part of the function of this process, right? And to the extent that we can be conscious of having this process be a function that expresses wisdom and expresses compassion, then that's the kind of karma that we'll be working with, right? Yeah.
So, using the banana tree, I guess. So can you actually take leaves off your identity, or can you only grow new leaves? I'm like saying, because I was a very athletic, you know, jock for most of my life, and I had an injury,
mm-hmm.
and then I have to change my identity, because I can no longer do do everything I could before.
Yes.
So is that still part of me, or can I, you know, I know it's kind of...
Well, your past is certainly still part of you, right? The condition, so the one way to understand it would be all of the results of the conditions and the karma are here in this moment. Those things are here, right? But the resultants are here, and those are the causes and the conditions of this moment. And then there's some activity that happens, sometimes volitional, sometimes not, and then the next moment happens, right? So you can add leaves, you can take off leaves. Ultimately, we can't really function in the world without some sense of identity, right? So we try to pick some skillful leaves to work with, right? Knowing that they are changing. So as you said, changes in the body is one of the ways that we are often very abruptly confronted with who we thought we were. You know, I think the teaching of Buddha nature is you're always a whole being. Right? You're always a complete being, whether your body's functioning well or not. But it's more about what we're talking today is more about how is that expressed, and how is that expressed skillfully, and how is that expressed in relation to the rest of the world? Yes?
I was thinking, have this reaction to the explicit teaching of no self,
mm-hmm.
because I don't feel like I experience or work with it, the concept explicitly in my practice, or I don't feel like I that's something that comes up. I was trying to categorize and come up with a phrase for it, like it's some sort of either it's not really a superfluous tool, or it seems somewhat irrelevant or not useful. Not useful isn't even the right word. It, to some degree it is, but it's not. It's like you brought it up and I thought, oh gosh, I haven't thought about that in such a long time. So uh-huh. I guess my question is, do other people experience that way? I don't feel like it's not so much worried about it as curious. And
well, back to Reverend Mule's question, I would say, are you the same person when you sit down as you are when you get up?
Well, I'm never the same person.
Right.
But to think of, I guess to think of, to sort of use the structure of the explicit idea of self, whether I have a constant self or an inconstant self, I guess sometimes I get tripped up on that, trying to make it feel like it means something to me when it doesn't. I'm not so sure I find it useful within my sitting or sort of zazen, not just sitting, but my constant zazen practice, I guess.
Okay. There's no need to add a concept if you don't find the concept useful.
Well, but I think the question is, I guess my question is, I'm curious how others find it useful. You know, how?
Well, I think those, you know, so the times when you might be feeling some pain about the way you perceive yourself,
mm-hmm.
would be the times when you might find it most useful.
Yeah.
Right.
And what about the concept of, I've heard people talk about the need to actually develop a self before you can begin to forget the self. You know, a sense that there is a you, because you're so alienated from it.
Right, back to starting with noticing and acknowledging and accepting what's really there.
Yeah,
absolutely. If you don't start there, then you don't have anything to work with. Yeah. Great, thank you. Right, I'm aware of our time, so.
May our intentions meekly extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's ways. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. Unsurpassable, I vow to become it.